should there be reservations in colleges, or do we have to start at the kindergarten level? Because I would say that if starting at the kindergarten level, if you track people's progress of different communities, you will find that the divergence in performance is happening at a very early age. And if they are diverging in their level of capabilities at a very early age, and then you're waiting until they reach college, and suddenly this big gap that exists, you want to bridge it artificially by putting them in the same class, you're asking for trouble. Civilizations are opposed to each other, and this has always been the case since the Romans and the Greeks were fighting, and more recent centuries, the British and the French were at war with each other over the colonies, and now US and China having. So the clash of civilizations has been going on, and the crusades, you know, the Christian world and the Muslim world fighting. So civilizational competition for market share, because they have ideas and their own competing ideas, has been there. Now, we've had peaceful civilizational competition. I mean, the Advaitis and the Vishishta Advaitis and the Vaitis and the Buddhists and Charvaks, and they've been fighting each other, not with violence, but they've been looking for market share. They've been looking to convert. So when Adi Shankara would win, the whole monastery, the whole community would have to come over to his point of view. So this friendly competition, discussion, debate-wise, has been happening in India also. It's just that in the rest of the world, it becomes violent. Physical violence, because the stakes are higher. Practical, short-term, quick. I think you should put, being in Mumbai, you should put some pressure on the Mumbai billionaires who are funding all this stuff and have Manthans, invite them out, don't insult them, be very courteous. I'm happy to come anytime in person or through Zoom or whatever and discuss with them and give them our findings. We have more than in the book. We have many more findings. And let's hear from them why they're doing it and would they like to reconsider? Would they like to get an annual report from us about what's the scorecard of the place you're funding, how are they doing, what are your personal values towards your dharma, and what is the value system that you're funding? This is, I think, in Mumbai, would be the most important thing you could do.
We are a tradition that relies, that used to rely at least, on very tight definition, precise language, things like that. I think we need to go back and understand what the left sells us in, you know, in these nicely couched language before we can subscribe to them.
A very good morning to all of you. Thanks, Rajiv ji. Thanks, Vijay ji. I think, and I must admit, because I'm sure there are a lot of people who haven't yet read the book, it was really important for us to hear from you, the whole background, and get a perspective. We do have people who've probably read the book, so you have some questions which have already come in. I will start with some of them. As we said, we are open for more questions, so please keep passing them on. And the first question is just based on something which you said. You said that you were prepared for a fight. You knew that because you're going to name, and you have named institutions, you have probably named some people, there would be some backlash. But the more important question, sir, just like you mentioned about the Ravana book, where you've taken some of these people head on in a book, are you planning or have you already done some engagement with the corporates, with the consultants and with the multinationals that you spoke about on the topic that you just have brought out?
Thank you for a wonderful question. You see, I know I've met Anand Mahindra and liked him a lot. This is before he gave any money, because I had been tracking all this Harvard stuff for 15 years or more. And so S. Gurumurthy, when he heard my presentation long back, more than a decade ago, he said, you know, I want to set you up a meeting with Anand Mahindra. Go to Mumbai, talk to him. He's the guy who ought to know all this. And then he will help you, you know, convince other industrialists and so on, so we don't get trapped in it. So I went and I came to meet Mahindra here, went to his office, sat in his private office, very nice, beautiful place, and he had lunch. Two of us ate lunch together. He gave me all the time. And I left my PowerPoint copies also behind with my findings on this is the bias there. These are the examples. This is what they're writing. This is what they write about China, but this is what they write about India. They do not invite Tibetan separatists. They are thrown out, but they invite Kashmir separatists. So I gave all kind of stuff. And in spite of that, and in spite of many other attempts later on by emails and by social media, whatever, they went ahead and did this. So they can't blame me for going public when they did not want to engage with me privately. And I have always wanted to engage. I've met Ajay Piramal in his Piramal Tower 2-3 times personally. And always I've given him my previous books which talk about similar things and told him all this stuff. So you see, they can't say, why has he gone public? It's because you guys went ahead and did something which I told you was a bad idea. And even now, the point is, they have not engaged any independent expert to go and do an audit. You should do a civilizational audit of the funding you're doing. If you're an industrialist, you always hire an auditor to check out if the factory is good, if the products are good, if your accounts and books are good. You always have an independent audit. So if in the same way, if you are a philanthropist, investing in your civilization to be studied in a foreign country, which is rather strange, you should at least have had somebody do an audit. So since they have not done any of that, our book is an audit. We're doing it as a gift, as a favor to these people, saying, here is our audit. And I want to say that Ratan Sharda ji, who's here, dear friend and very hardworking, he's been trying to get a meeting with these people, not successful. So it is not up to us. It is up to them. But, you know, if they don't want to talk, fine. We'll just go on talking publicly. And we are very clear what we have written about them, and yes, we have named them hundreds of times in this book. What we have written about them in this book is only like 5-10% of all the stuff we know, and we're going to keep producing more. And at some point in time, my feeling is that they will quietly start making changes. Maybe they will not want to admit it, it's too much for the ego, but they'll quietly start making changes, is my guess.
Thank you, sir. On the title of the book, and you know, I have some Hindi background, so I always thought you're also referring to maybe a Hindi translation, which can just say Aasteen Ke Saanp. But more than that, sir, we wanted to get your feel because you mentioned about China somewhere. Somewhere does China figure in the snake agenda as yes. A snake for India?
Yes. So there is a chapter on China also. China comes up in multiple ways. One is directly at Harvard. China also is studying, China is involved in Harvard, but they do not allow Harvard to discuss Chinese history, culture, politics, society, human rights, Uyghur Muslims, Tibetans. They don't allow Harvard to do that, which is something our billionaires could learn from and also create some responsible constraints on what can be done with their money. And China is piggybacking on Piramal. There is a T.H. Chan, which is funded by Chinese people, named after their father, T.H. Chan School of Public Health, which is the largest private donation ever received by Harvard. It has come from the Chinese, huge amount. And they've taken over this whole public health. And this public health school in Harvard is so powerful, they have influenced the World Health Organization. And during this whole COVID thing, they made sure that there is nothing negative about China coming out as the origin and all that, because they funded it and they're using it for their purpose. Now this T.H. Chan School of Public Health, which is very famous, underneath it is the Piramal Public Health. So we are almost like we are a subsidiary under the Chinese, which is kind of very silly. Piramal is under the T.H. Chan School. He's allowed that. So now the T.H. Chan School come here to Mumbai. The Piramal Center is used as their collection hub to collect data, to collect do surveillance. There's a lot of genetic and lot of public health databases being collected by Harvard using their footprint here with these billionaires, which we didn't talk about earlier, but that's a very big story in this book. How Harvard's footprints in India, both with these billionaires and with Ashoka, and with the government, are being used to do data surveillance, data mining of all sorts, and the Chinese are in it also. So there is plenty that we've talked about China. There is also a center in Ashoka, which is their China center, and this China center in Ashoka has tremendous influence in India, and it has its bias. You want to talk about meritocracy, the meritocracy conference?
We've named five departments in Ashoka, and one of the departments is the China Studies department in Ashoka. Now, the China Studies department in Ashoka has two goals, it seems like, from the work that they're doing. One is to create a good brand for China in India amongst Indian scholars, and I'll tell you how. And the other is to sort of undermine India. So let's talk about the undermining part first. In the book, we talk about meritocracy, an attack on meritocracy, and the Indian engineering institutions. Now, Ashoka has a tie-up with Harvard. So Harvard does this conference in, Tarun Khanna. Tarun Khanna is, by the way, an advisor to the Niti Aayog. Also, and he is the head of the Lakshmi Mittal Institute at Harvard. He chairs this meritocracy workshop of China and India in Shanghai, no less. And the participants are some scholars from China, Ashoka University scholars, and Harvard University scholars. Of course, the Indian scholars from Harvard and Ashoka go to China and talk about how meritocracy is a sham, and it's essentially caste capital, and how it's affecting engineering, education, and how the outcome is all, there is variability in outcome, there's no equal outcome, and therefore, this is a serious issue in India, because meritocracy is caste capital, essentially. Whereas the Chinese go and talk about how great China is, excellence in China through meritocracy in the past, and in the present, and how they will continue to do all the great things that the Chinese are cut out to do. So this is one aspect. Now, the second thing that the China Studies Department in Ashoka University does is it has tie-ups with Harvard and Harvard Yangqing Institute, which is an institute in China. And what they do is Ashoka is sort of the main broker that gets scholars and students from universities like Somaya, Christ College in Bangalore, Jadavpur University, because they're trying to establish China Studies departments in those universities as well. So they train scholars and students through fellowships that come from China and Harvard through Ashoka. And Ashoka gathers all these people and then sends them to Harvard and Harvard Yangqing Institute to study China the way the Chinese want China to be studied. So our China Studies is not an Indian view of China, but it is more a Chinese view of how China should be studied. So it's a propaganda thing. And we all know what Confucius Institutes are doing in the West. Even in America, they're shutting down Confucius Institutes because they just seem to be the propaganda outposts of China. So this is happening within Ashoka as a two-pronged thing that Ashoka has decided to do, all funded by Indian billionaires.
Sir, you spoke about the caste issue. Somewhere, I think, as a society, we all accept and do need to accept that there has been an issue with the way the whole caste thing has impacted the Indian society. So how do we accept what may have gone wrong and address that issue, and at the same time tackle the menace that you said is now emerging?
So you see, I'm a patient, I have an illness, and I want the doctor to diagnose me. But I don't want a bad diagnosis. I don't want him to tell me that my disease is the same as somebody else, because it's easy to say that. I don't want a false diagnosis, it'll be a false treatment. So we do not have American racism. American racism was, blacks came from a different continent, whites came from a different continent, they didn't evolve together, they had no interrelationship. Their relationship starts as slave and slave master. It doesn't start like in our country, it didn't start like slave master. So we have a whole different dynamic of among different people. There is exploitation, there is misuse, we have to solve it. Now, there are many, we can have a whole discussion on should there be reservations in colleges, or do we have to start at the kindergarten level? Because I would say that if starting at the kindergarten level, if you track people's progress of different communities, you will find that the divergence in performance is happening at a very early age. And if they are diverging in their level of capabilities at a very early age, and then you're waiting until they reach college, and suddenly this big gap that exists, you want to bridge it artificially by putting them in the same class, you're asking for trouble. You're not even being fair to them. Putting a person with low marks into the same class as the rest of them is like taking somebody in the seventh class in school and putting him in the same class, classroom as 11th class. It is not going to work. It's not going to be fair to him. So the place to start, and these people need help if they don't have educated parents, if they don't have parents with good money, income, coaching, all that stuff, is true. So they need to be helped at a very early age. Indian education system, the NCERT and all that, has failed to provide universal education of a good quality right from childhood, which is the way to China did it. China started with very good primary education right from the time of Mao. And in 50 years, two generations, they produced a very highly educated Chinese society. And we haven't done that, and we're trying to do jugaad at the end point of education rather than at the beginning point of education. So that's where I think the solution has to be.
So, you spoke about Harvard in particular, but I think in general, India has been an exporter of a lot of students into the Western institutions, not just US, but even other continents. So at the one stage, you have a lot of Indian population building there. These are people who have been schooled and brought up here. How do we get them to probably put our views or the view that you think is the appropriate one to counter this in the US itself?
So I've given proposals to the Ministry of External Affairs that our foundation is ready to put out these workshops. We can put out orientation classes like Chinese have when Chinese students come to America. They give them orientation in China and then in US. To sort of advise them on what are the issues they'll raise, how to answer them, what to answer, what not to answer, kind of make them culturally sensitive to what the American view is. Now, India doesn't have the same hostilities politically as China in the last few years, but there is cultural animosity like we are finding here. But there's no orientation. Ministry of External Affairs got nothing to do with who goes, where they go, why they go, what they study. There's zero. Nor is there a rating service which says, see, Americans are always developing an index of who is what is the level on which index. I've told Mr. Jaishankar a few days ago, we should have an index of American universities that are teaching Indian civilization to allow a student to know, if I go here, there's level of reliability on Hinduism, Vedas, Indian society, Indian culture is X. If I go there, it is higher, here it is lower. And if we published an index like that, it would put them on guard. It would put them on guard that somebody is watching, somebody is evaluating. Somebody is, if I do nonsense, it will have consequences. My rating will go down. Just like they've said that Adani's rating of ESG will go down, we should say, if Harvard does this, your rating of India studies will go down. And the Ministry of External Affairs has to say that. We tell we don't want any money even. We just want your backing, emotional, psychological backing, kind that those people should know that the Indian government cares. And so this has value to the students, it will have value to the country, but you know, we don't see leadership. We see that they are scared, they give all kind of reasons, they don't want any of this, they are saying we are a free country, everybody can go, do what they want, so that is what is happening here.
At a fundamental level, is this an issue where people are trying to sort of take it as an issue against Hinduism, or is it against India as a country? Do you find there a religious bias to this whole debate, or is it purely at a country level?
So first, the third part you didn't ask is it pro or anti-Modi? Okay.
So that's...
So let me tell you, I've lived in the United States for 52 years, and I quit all my for-profit activity 30 years ago to spend full time in this because I found this bias. It had nothing to do with Modi. It had nothing to do with Modi. It has been there for as long as I can remember. Now, so for, first of all, this business that, you know, Modi is a bad guy, therefore we hate Hinduism, that is a cop-out, that's an excuse. They were hating Hinduism even before that. So there were a lot of reasons. One was the church, historically. Another was this leftists. In my earlier book, Breaking India, Breaking India came out in 2011, long before Modi. And Breaking India talks about all these problems. And we have, even in 2005, a book called Invading the Sacred, which has been reprinted as Academic Hindu Phobia. You can buy that. That came out in 2005, a decade before Modi. So these problems that we've mentioned are there for a long time, and we've analyzed who does it, why they do it. It's not only the church, because there are a lot of Jewish people. They're not churchward people. But the liberal left has a problem because, you know, they can't understand this great civilization, this very old civilization, more diverse than their own programs for diversity, and it doesn't fit the Marxist lens. It's something that they have to fight. But I'll tell you, a large part of the problem is our own people. Our own people go there looking for money, and this is a good way to get money. You say that I will champion the poor, and you, the white guilt people, hire me, give me the money, and your white guilt will go away. So this is a way to fight white guilt by having them give money and resources to the leftists of India. Indian leftists have gone and perpetuated this against us, I would say, is a very big factor.
I also want to say that this is actually a good thing, because ordinary Hindus who've been sleeping and who've not been participating either way, just being cautious, it's affecting their own family. It's affecting their children. It's affecting their workplace. So this is actually a good thing, because when the ordinary Hindu who does nothing gets affected, then and his own life is at stake, then perhaps he'll wake up.
But, you know, that's like saying, I've been telling the person to stop smoking, he wouldn't. Now he's got cancer, it's a good thing he have to stop smoking.
So, sir, two questions. One, are there any other countries, religions, where you think a similar agenda has been pursued by the West? More specifically, is there a case to try and align with somebody like that, say the Jews who've had an agenda against them, or say, do the Republicans identify more with a right-wing agenda? So is there a global ally for us, and is there somebody else who's been through this?
Yeah, so first we have to understand that the civilizations are opposed to each other, and this has always been the case since the Romans and the Greeks were fighting, and more recent centuries, the British and the French were at war with each other over the colonies, and now US and China having. So the clash of civilizations has been going on, and the Crusades, you know, the Christian world and the Muslim world fighting. So civilizational competition for market share, because they have ideas and their own competing ideas, has been there. Now, we've had peaceful civilizational competition. I mean, the Advaitis and the Vishishta Advaitis and the Vaitis and the Buddhists and Charvaks, and they've been fighting each other, not with violence, but they've been looking for market share. They've been looking to convert. So when Adi Shankara would win, the whole monastery, the whole community would have to come over to his point of view. So this friendly competition, discussion, debate-wise, has been happening in India also. It's just that in the rest of the world, it becomes violent. Physical violence, because the stakes are higher. So I would say the clash of civilizations is an old thing. Now, it affects us more than others because we have not got our act together in terms of a grand narrative, in terms of a defense strategy. We are not strategic thinkers. Indians are not strategic thinkers, whereas in the past they were. If you look at the Mahabharata, it's a strategy. It's all strategy. But British made sure, Muslim rulers made sure that we just become survivors. We just surviving, ke theek hai, mere ko dal roti mil rahi hai, gana ho raha hai, cricket match jeet liya, emotional. You feed people emotions, they don't need strategy. They do not need strategy. So we are vulnerable for weakness. We are a target not because there's something particularly wrong about us that they think. We are a target because while they're all fighting each other, but they're strategic. So like, for example, Christians also want to expand into the Arab world, but there's no way the Muslim world will allow them. So because they can't go into Iran and start doing these things, when they do, they're thrown out. They were trying it in Afghanistan. So whereas here it is open. The biggest, you know, the fastest conversion into Christianity of any community in the world is in Punjab today. Today, right now. And I don't want to digress into my head this whole discussion with the Khalistanis in Canada. And I told them, your problem is not Hindus, your problem is the Christian church doing it to you. And they were surprised. I mean, their leader said, you are right. But the average young fellow Khalistani, not smart enough to know that that is what is destroying his village. It is not Hindu people destroying his village. So you see, our leadership, whether it is gurus, have not taken on this battle. I don't, because they want to get the Nobel Prize. They want to be goody-goody guy. And they'll say, oh, I'll be very nice, peaceful, and maybe they'll get Nobel Prize. None of them going to get Nobel Prize, you can be sure. But they're not doing this job of Kshatriyata. And then you have this confusion among our people. Shashi Tharoor writes in his book, Why I'm a Hindu, he writes that Hindutva is bad because it is very political. And so there is this argument that our gurus also give, Shashi Tharoor gives, many people give, that Hindus are supposed to be very mystical, go inside, do your yoga and bhakti, and leave all this alone. Don't get involved in politics, in social activism. So if you follow that, then you'll be weak. So my counter is that if that were the case, why is Shri Krishna guiding the war? The whole Mahabharata is political and military action. It is social action. You have to fight the adharma. Why does Bhagwan come as Sri Ramchandra to fight Ravan? It is social, political intervention right from God, right from Bhagwan. And why do all our deities have weapons in them when you go to the mandir? So this business that we are supposed to not be Kshatriya is also nonsense. The absence of Kshatriyata among Hindus, and I'm not talking about physical violence, rabid running around, I'm talking about in your mind, the way you think strategically, your leadership, ability to do Purva Paksha and deconstruct the other side and give them thoughtful answers and be strong, lead from front. These kind of qualities is what we need. And because we don't have enough of this, we are an easy target.
Rajiv, want to add one more thing? I think it's just a suggestion that came up. Like how the Hindu Punjabis gave one son to the Sikh tradition as Kshatriyas, I think every mother can give one child to fight Dharma, and I think that, you know, that could perhaps work.
So, I know you've mentioned about the government at a couple of places in terms of educational policy, foreign intervention. You also mentioned about the change in regime that's happened. We've also seen a lot of tightening on the FCRA, which was towards curbing inflow of money into some of the sectors that you mentioned. So overall, where do you see today's government in India in terms of this particular issue? And have you had any direct dialogue with the government which you can share with us?
Yeah, one of the things we can take credit for is this FCRA. Because in this book, Breaking India, 12 years ago, there's a huge section on this foreign funding NGOs. We're giving examples, who funds what. So many names we have mentioned of the Westerners, British, European, American, all kind of Lutheran church, this and that. And so many Indians who are doing it and how the channels. In fact, the whole book was written on tracing the money. And we had workshop after workshop in Delhi on foreign-funded NGOs, and we advised, wrote papers, concept papers, which eventually turned into all these new policies. So it did happen, but it took a long time. So the thing is that we are hoping this will also, this Breaking India 2.0, which is what this book is, will also have the same impact. It will take time. Things, unfortunately, are very slow here. Now, regarding whether we've had meetings, yes, I had meetings in the previous trip. We were here, September, October, and also during this time, I've met important people, and they take notice. I think there will be, my guess is, there will be some scrutiny on people like Omid Diyar. I think they are going to be on the radar for good reason. They ought to be, right? Soros there is on the radar, but Omi Diyar is far worse. They should check it out for themselves, not take anything we are saying for at face value, but check it out for themselves. I also feel that as far as these billionaires are concerned, it's very sensitive because on the one hand, these billionaires are considered very patriotic and they're also probably funding all the political parties. And on the other hand, they're going overseas and doing all these things. How do you stop them? It's not very easy because the billionaire will say, it's my money. Who are you? Get lost. It's my money. I'll do what I want with it. That's fair enough. But I think the public pressure will build up. And on these billionaires, they will eventually have to do something. They cannot go on doing it as blatantly. And every time somebody occupying a chair or a directorship or something with their name goes out and does some nonsense against us, now that we've alerted our people, there will be many, many voices that will point it out. For example, one of the worst persons, anti-Hindu, anti-India, anti-Indian government, is a man called Hanson at Stanford University. And guess what is his title? Official title is Reliance Dhirubhai Ambani Professor at Stanford. That is his title. Just go looking for, just look Hanson, Stanford, Reliance, and search, you will find it. And then go look for his books, what he's written, what is the links. It's so open, he's not some subtle little guy. He's blatantly out there saying that this is all saffron and they're against minorities and it's a sham democracy. He's one of those coaching, because he's so senior, he's coaching these journalists all over the world that are writing all this nonsense. We have to go to the root cause. And those of us who are funding the snakes, we have to tell them to stop.
So, sir, we want to do the formal book launch for the Mumbai audience, but before that, we always have one last question. To this audience, and I told you what sort of audience we have here, what is that one message that you will share, both you and ma'am, if you can give us that one message, sir?
So the practical thing, we could have a very theoretical that we should do whatever, but I'm saying practical has to be something actionable now. I mean, so rather than saying raise your kids differently, because that's very important, but that takes a long time, you know. Practical, short-term, quick. I think you should put, being in Mumbai, you should put some pressure on the Mumbai billionaires who are funding all this stuff and have Manthans invite them out. Don't insult them. Be very courteous. I'm happy to come anytime in person or through Zoom or whatever and discuss with them and give them our findings. We have more than in the book. We have many more findings. And let's hear from them why they're doing it and would they like to reconsider? Would they like to get an annual report from us about what's the scorecard of the place you're funding, how are they doing, what are your personal values towards your dharma, and what is the value system that you're funding. This is, I think, in Mumbai, would be the most important thing you could do. Second thing, if I may have, second one, is we want to turn this into film, and we need help to get film made. And this is the city where films are made. So anyone who wants to help us in filmmaking, script writing, any of that stuff, please get in touch with us later on. Thank you so much.
I just want to say that whenever you're participating in any of these DEI sustainability initiatives, please look and see what they actually mean. Understand what is D, what is E, what is I, what is diversity, what is equity, what is inclusion. Equity is not equality. So, you know, arm yourself with the definitions and the knowledge so that you can then reject these sort of training programs. Even this whole environmental movement, you have to look in and see what exactly are they talking about. What is sustainability, 2030 goals of UNESCO? We have such high regard for UN institutions, but they are all extremely corrupt, and they are, you know, they are essentially the machinery, the mechanism through which these social sciences ideas are coming to your doorstep. So don't just blindly accept these things. Get definitions. We are a tradition that used to rely at least on very tight definition, precise language, things like that. I think we need to go back and understand what the left sells us in these nicely couched language before we can subscribe to them.
Thank you so much. May I now call upon stage Honorable Retired Governor Padmanabh Acharyaji, our local MLA who's always with us for all the programs, Parag Aravani ji, Nagar Sangh Chalak, Mumbai Nagar Sangh Chalak Suresh Bhagiria ji, and well-known author Ratan Sharda ji to join us with the authors to unveil the book for the audience of Mumbai.
I do want to say, besides this book, this book came out 3-4 months ago, the Snakes in the Ganga we just launched. This was launched in the last 3 weeks, Varna Jati Caste, 150-page toolkit, how to talk back, how to teach your children to talk back, how you can talk back. This is to educate all the technocrats that don't have to be IITians, but anyone who's a technocrat, and not only tech people nowadays, this is going to go into other industries that are exporting, pharma and banking and automobiles and chemicals and whatever. This is the Battle for IIT, another 150-page book, very simple, straightforward. What is the argument they are giving, and what is our counter-argument? Very quick read. And this is... the 10 heads of Ravan. I'll tell you what the 10 heads are. So the 10 heads are Romila Thapar, Sheldon Pollock, Michael Witzel, Devdutt Patnaik, Irfan Habib, Shashi Tharoor, Audrey Tuske, Ramachandra Guha, Kancha Elaya, and Wendy Doniger. These are 10 heads. I also have a couple of books on artificial intelligence. This is the second one we came out with. The first one, because my background professionally is in AI, it's called Artificial Intelligence and the Future of Power, 5 Battlegrounds. It's about policy in AI, how it affects society, and how it affects common people, and what you should do to make sure AI is for good and not for bad things, but right now it's both ways. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Padmanabh ji. Thank you, Ratan ji. Thank you, Suresh ji. Thank you, Parag ji.